I think they get it.
We're playing basketball with the microphone.
It's like two guys trying to get through a doorway at the same time and getting wedged.
You just let me handle everything.
Uh-huh.
We're in Atlanta. You don't have to move it close to me. I can modulate my voice.
Oh, okay.
We're sharing a mic.
Fine.
Like lovers do. this is Linoleum Knife, a podcast of the cinema. I'm Dave White of Movies.com. You are Alonzo Duralde of somewhere, therap.com, and also What the Flick. We have a guest. We'll introduce him in a second. We're in Atlanta. That was a Gone with the Wind song. That song they play in Gone with the Wind.
The Gone with the Wind song.
Yeah. And then...
hey, Max Steiner, write me the Gone with the Wind song.
We don't have a cassette player here in Atlanta because they live now. and then because it's Atlanta, you know, because Gone with the Wind and stuff. So
this is our very first on the road episode.
Somebody had the big idea. Wouldn't it be great? Like, this is such a good idea. Wouldn't it be great if we went 2,000 miles away to visit family that we don't get to see but like once a year, and let's spend a couple of hours ignoring them so that we can make a podcast happen.
Okay, do you see, is there like a barbecue going on that we're ignoring right now? No, people are at work. People are doing stuff. We have time to do this, and we are...
We could be outside enjoying the plantations and the peanuts and the peaches.
Okay.
And the...
That's...
The roller rinks from ATL, that movie that was so good. We could be doing a whole bunch of Atlanta-y things,
okay.
But instead we're doing this.
Well,
and why?
Because we're a professional show, and we have sponsors that we have commitments to. We can't just take a week off when we feel like it.
Our sponsors will not mind.
Well,
if we take off a week,
I didn't want to test it. You know, you don't know how they're going to be.
We're sponsored by this book. I forget the name of it for a second, but when it's time to do the thing, I'll do the thing.
We're sponsored by two books, don't forget.
Two books, yes. I got to pull up their other...
Yeah, you do.
Yeah.
So while you're getting your act together...
Introduce the guest.
Yes, I will do that. So excited to have with us. If we knew how to Skype and bring people in remotely, we would have had this person on by now.
He was Skype.
He was on, but not into the show. He was once on the show for about 45 seconds when we were talking the Avengers, if you're really paying attention to this program. But anyway...
That, I believe, you like... It's like a phone held to the microphone.
Something along those... Yeah, that level of sophistication. But anyway, so we're thrilled to have with us today one of my oldest and dearest friends in the world, who is also the film critic for Creative Loafing here in Atlanta, and the editor?
I'm the editor, yes.
The editor of the Living in Town supplement of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Please welcome Kurt Holman.
Thank you, guys. I'm sorry, I was here with Dave Sex Happening, and not Dave White.
Yes. It's Dave Sex Happening. It's my new name, by the way. Thank you for reminding me of my new name.
Dave Sex Happening, Black Emperor Candyface. Yeah. Who can keep up?
Now, you guys mentioned, I think, recently about how like every movie set in Atlanta now, or said something like that.
It's ceased to be a novelty.
They're all shot in Atlanta.
It has ceased to be a novelty when I see Atlanta in a movie now. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like, oh, it used to be, ooh, Atlanta. Now it's, oh, tax break.
Yeah. Well, and for us here, it's like, you'll see like the trailers all over the place, you know, and it's like, it'll be like, coming soon, The Change Up. And it's like, great, The Change Up, you know. So
have people here gotten, do you get that level of annoyance in traffic when you encounter a Star Wagon? Because that's when you know you've really crossed over from being like, ooh, exciting, they're making a movie, to get out of my way.
I think the traffic's so bad here all the time anyway that it's kind of a drop in the bucket, you know. But the people who would like pick up on that would be like, ooh, and there's always like, ooh, I saw Owen Wilson at Owen's at Johnny's Hideaway for the Hall Pass, you know, filming and stuff like that. So.
They made Hall Pass here?
Yes. Yeah.
How proud you must be.
Good going.
The Hunger Games Catching Fire, I think, was the one we're most proud of, and next to that is probably The Walking Dead.
Oh, well, sure.
What about that one?
What about anything by Tyler Perry?
All of them by Tyler Perry.
great employer, you know, big employer here.
What except about that but one not with union, Demi right? Moore? The one with Demi Moore and was it David Duchovny where they were
living
in the suburbs, but they were a pretend family. It was all about
marketing. Yeah, the Joneses.
Product placement right? in people's actual lives.
It's called The Joneses.
Is that what it's called? I don't remember what it's called. It's not good, but it's a fun concept. Yeah.
Well, I like the idea of Atlanta not being the Gone with the Wind, Tara, bastion of the Old South, but being kind of like generic American chain store city.
You're America's Vancouver.
Yeah, it seems more like the experience of living in Atlanta than the other thing.
Well, and the Jason Bateman and Ryan Reynolds pee into a fountain movie was here,
yeah,
as I recall.
Yeah.
So. Oh, is that also here?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
That's almost Anchorman, as good as Hall Pass.
But not a real fountain, I'm pretty sure.
Anchorman 2 was here about the dawn of 24-hour cable, even though it was set in New York, and Atlanta is the home of 24-hour cable, you know, so it's like...
Thanks. Thanks, Anchorman 2.
I don't know what's happening now.
Well, let's get into the movies. Million Ways to Die in the West.
There are a lot of them.
Yes, we... You know,
I just woke up from sleeping for 12 hours, by the way. I don't have anything good to say today, then I can't be blamed for that.
I'm very proud of Dave White for flying cross country.
No Xanax.
Mm-hmm. Like Marky Mark.
No crying.
Like Marky Mark in Good Vibrations, drug free. So put the crack up.
No super being afraid. Like there was one turbulence moment that was pretty gross. Mm-hmm. That I was just like, okay, great. The one time I don't take the Xanax is when I'm actually going to die because it was a big. It made other people in the plane go, "Hey!" So like, when the other people in the plane who are all dummies and don't care about anything, when they start getting upset, then you know that your fears are probably justified. That happened. I did yell at a person, but they were not a person on the plane. It was a lady.
There's a man on the wing of the plane. Yeah.
A lady who worked for Delta.
I
yelled at her. But she deserved it because she was being snotty and flippant
to
me.
No. She was trying to calm you down.
No, she wasn't. She was making fun of me.
No. She gave you a big wink as a way to sort of like try.
Wink at me at 5:30 in the morning. That's not what you do.
She was trying to defuse the situation and you were being genius bar with her.
Sometimes you got to go genius. Sometimes you got to go genius bar on people.
All right. Well,
do people know what you're talking about?
I don't know what.
Oh, that sorry. Is. Okay.
Long-time listener Kurt Holman doesn't know what we're talking about.
Dave, one time when we went to the Apple Store,
justifiably
was upset about his new computer overheating and not working
with reason,
and so he, you know, got. He expressed his crossness.
And I did not raise my voice.
To the Genius Bar guy. And I had to tell him afterwards, okay, from now on, I do the talking. Because that guy looked terrified. Because
too bad.
Dave doesn't realize that even when he's speaking in what he thinks is a calm and rational tone of voice.
Like right now.
It's terrifying to people that don't know him. They just think, who is this big lug and why is he barking at me with that scary deep voice? So you,
I don't know what you're talking about.
It's been an ongoing thing to kind of explain the day to translate Dave into the rest of the world because he thinks he thinks he's being nice as pie, and even if he is, it still sounds threatening to the.
I was unhappy. I was expressing my unhappiness both at the Genius Bar dude that one day, who should be used to it by now because Apple things are garbage, And then I was expressing my displeasure at the way LAX was non-functioning yesterday morning and making people walk through 100-degree basement tunnels to get from one gate to another because they were having a power outage.
Only to send us back to the
only to send us back to where we started. And I said to the lady, I just walked a mile to get here. She's like, not a mile, winks at me. Ha ha ha. I was like, well, then it was unpleasant. How about that? And she's like, well, you have to go back to the gate because that's where you are now. And I was like, fun words.
I'm imagining Edie McClurg in the role of the woman talking to Dave. Yeah. Yeah.
Exactly. So, okay, Million Ways.
We don't think there's a problem. Delta is a righteous dude.
Well, that low intense way of talking can be scary, more scary and intimidating than like actual yelling talking. Like Western villains, like Liam Neeson in A Million Ways to Die in the West.
Thank you. Nice segue. Yes. No. Yeah. See, Dave always sounds like somebody who's about to go off and is trying not to, and that's what makes people scared.
Not true.
But I'm just saying to people who don't know you, who don't know that you're a wuss, they don't know that you are a kitten, they think that you are a Rottweiler.
I'm a delight.
You are. So yeah, A Million Ways to Die in the West. So it's Seth MacFarlane. It's his on-screen debut after being the voice of Ted in his directorial debut. Is it just me, or does he look like the gingerbread man in Shrek? He has this round, flat face and these two black eyes, and it's a little disconcerting.
It's like I was thinking of what Quint says in Jaws about the shark. You know, he's got black eyes, a doll's eyes, you know.
I think that's a fair assessment.
And it's kind of a shame because he's kind of presenting himself in kind of the nebbishy role in the movie.
Right.
But it doesn't have really endearing traits that you would find in someone like Woody Allen or even like Bob Hope in The Pale Face, or something like that.
He's got a frat boy face that you want to punch.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's true. Yeah, the it's weird that he's playing an underdog and still kind of coming off as sort of like a douchey, you mm-hmm. know, like alpha male.
Yeah.
But it's funny.
It is funny. Yeah. I mean, I laughed enough. You know, we always talk about, like, did you laugh six times? Did you, like, I laughed pretty regularly throughout. The premise, basically, is that Seth MacFarlane plays a sheep farmer and is miserable in the West and just thinks that, like, everything is toxic and terrible. And
nerdy high school sophomore.
Right. And then his school marm girlfriend, Amanda,
the cheerleader,
Amanda Seyfried, dumps him and takes up with
the jock,
arrogant mustache salon owner Neil Patrick Harris.
I think he's more of a preppy than a jock.
He's a preppy.
He's more of a lacrosse jock.
He's more of a, James Spader in Pretty in Pink.
He's a snooty preppy. How's that? Yeah.
Okay, and so then along comes Charlize Theron, who is
the girl who doesn't know she's pretty.
Right, who is unbeknownst to Seth MacFarlane is married to Liam Neeson,
who is the mean jock.
Who is the mean jock bully, the meanest desperado in the West. And
so there's your plot right there.
Yeah, as they point out, it's a high school movie. And you know, it kind of plays it doesn't. I don't know. I mean, do we even think it really is interested in being a parody of Westerns in terms of like the way Blazing Saddles was the sort of the tropes or the structure or whatever?
Well, it's weird,
of Westerns.
I think he likes Westerns more than Mel Brooks did when he made Blazing Saddles. Because they'll be like the opening credits, like long sweeping vistas and Monument Valley, and there's no. And then they kept showing like kind of the gloved mesa shapes of Monument Valley. And I was waiting for one to like be, you know, in a finger going up shape, you know. It's like, no, he's just kind of into it, you know. Like, horse chases and things like that. They'd be like, I'm going to just put the jokes aside for a while.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of felt like the joke is the anachronism of somebody being sort of a modern kind of nudge in the West, but which Blazing Saddles has a certain level of that, but there's no kind of, like, I'm making fun of this genre affectionately or otherwise. Like, I don't think he cares about Westerns. You don't come away from this movie thinking, oh, well, he's clearly seen Red River or something. You know, it's just like, it's just a backdrop drop for these jokes about frontier misery, basically.
Yeah.
I think, you know, I've never been a big Family Guy fan. Like, somebody will send me a 30-second clip and I'll think it's hilarious, but an entire episode, I can't take it. I think the sort of non-sequitur absurdist jokes work really well, and I think the scatology and the sex stuff here is kind of lazy.
Mm.
And as I said in my review on therap.com, and I say this as someone who thought that the funniest moment in Ted involved a hooker's bowel movement, you know? So it's not that I'm against sex and scatology in general, or even his, but this time it just kind of felt like, well, I got nothing else. I'll put that.
It's kind of like everyone else does it, so I might as well have a diarrhea joke or something like that.
Yeah, and it's like if you're going to have Neil Patrick Harris having explosive diarrhea into a cowboy hat.
And you have to.
And you have to, clearly. It's one thing to have him, you know, squatting and grunting and all that stuff. But then to show it, it's like, do we need to go that far?
That was somebody on the set, some prop person on the set saying, you know, I could probably make something that really looks like diarrhea. We can whip it up with
we're having chili at craft service.
Because you know the people who do that kind of thing in films are like, okay, they're sharing tips with each other about how do I make really authentic-looking fake diarrhea out of
chocolate
everyday household
cream corn.
Out of everyday household foods. How do I make it look like actual diarrhea? And then, so they learned it from someone on some other movie, and they were like, oh, I totally can do this for you.
It's been handed down like through the ages.
A hat full of prop diarrhea. Let's do it.
But, I mean, I'm not even trying to be prudish about it. Just, is it as funny to see it as it is to just suggest and imply it? And I don't think it is. Mm-hmm. I think once you actually show it, it's like it just sort of drags the whole, like, you're taking what's already a low joke and just dragging it further down. You know, I'm reminded of
it reminds you of your own diarrhea.
It does.
Too close.
No, Mel Brooks, his joke about Blazing Saddles was that it rises beneath vulgarity. And I think that McFarlane is trying to go beneath vulgarity, but it's mostly just vulgarity.
Mm-hmm. Well, I did like, I kind of appreciated how it had a sense of a sight gag, where, like, kind of the Seth Rogen-y movies, they're all kind of like just verbal gags. Uh-huh. And so it's almost like a good version of like the epic movie, date movie kind of genre, you know. So that's the positive, my positive reaction to
so
it.
Like, yeah. So like ZAZ, sort of that kind of comedy,
yeah,
where there's puns and stuff, but then they'll also throw
in jokes about like the running joke about how people pose in old, like, 19th century photographs.
Oh,
yeah.
I heard a guy smiled once. Shut up!
When the when Neil Patrick Harris does have diarrhea in the hat, and he fills up one hat and tries to knock another hat off the guy's head, and the guy won't, the guy keeps...
He swats his
hand away ineffectually, sort of, but still manages to do it, and does this, like, four times in a row. That was actually, I think, the funniest thing in the movie.
It's like the, it's also kind of like the, Sideshow Bob stepping on rakes thing, where if you just repeat the same thing in the right way, it might even like stop being funny and then be funny again.
Right. And Andy Kaufman singing 99 bottles of beer on the wall. It's
just a silent moment where no one runs away, no one gets super aggressive. They just keep repeating the thing,
and it's a gag that takes some time, which is nice because a lot of this stuff sort of zips by really quickly. But I mean, I think probably some of my favorite laughs were just, you know, again, it's in keeping with the theme of the movie. Just when people die from some super random thing that comes out of nowhere. Like, whoa, okay. So.
And now the wolves are dragging his body away, proving my point about the West.
We were talking about this somewhere, and I don't remember if we were talking about this here on the show, or if I was... Oh, wait, no. I was on the Sports Talk radio station. I'm on a sports talk radio station. Every once in a while, this sports talk radio station in D.C. calls me and is like, let's talk about movies, Dave. And so, like, we do. And they were asking me questions about Spider-Man versus X-Men versus whatever.
Now, there's a movie.
And I said, yeah, well, they love talking. These guys love talking about the superhero movies. And I said, it used to be that the dominant genre in American cinema was the Western. And there were millions of them. And they were how we told stories about life. And now it's superhero movies. Those are the way we tell... That's the way we tell stories about life now, through these superhero movies, as the big dominant genre. Well, this is now a Western sort of reclaiming the form of the Western and telling us absolutely nothing about anything, which I think is kind of cool and weird and also very funny. This is a film about nothing. It's actually about nothing. I mean, it looks like a Western. It has the form of an 80s high school movie, and it's still about nothing other than how many jokes can we throw at you and hope that 40% of them stick.
Well, and it's the thing about doing a Western is that it's not that the genre is dead, because there's always like there's always a Western
always
every year
somewhere.
But the Westerns are now like very self-conscious, as far as like either there's a joke version or like a grim deconstruction,
they're all
like
really
Unforgiven,
grim,
or even like 3:10 to Yuma, where it's like, "Ooh, we're just doing a fun Western," you know.
Yeah,
they're always self-conscious in some way.
Yeah, it can't just stand on its own. We were talking about. Did you watch the Maya Rudolph show?
I didn't see it. I heard pretty mixed things.
It didn't really work. I mean, I love her. And I love a lot of people involved in it. And the variety show has become the same thing, where you can't just do one. You either have to be commenting on them, or you have to be aggressively doing it in the way that they used to do it without changing it. And it's like, it's somewhere along the line, like, they stopped evolving. Whereas, I mean, Westerns, clearly, you know, from Tom Mix in the silent years to through, you know, John Ford and you know, Bud Bedecker and Sam Peckinpah, like, they were evolving and they were taking on different aspects, and some of them were darker and some of them were funnier and whatever. And then at some point, it just became so uncool that, yeah, the only way you could do one is to then comment upon them. Mm. And that kind of is what happened to the variety show, and which was a staple of radio and you know, television for the first, like, three decades of TV, the 50s, 60s, and 70s. So, yeah, it's a weird genre to touch back into. Because you can't just do it. You're doing something to it somehow, you know. I wish they had had more. I wish Sarah Silverman had had more to do. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Her is kind of a one joke thing, and it's a not all that funny joke that they just tell over and over again without building upon it. The idea that she's a hooker who sleeps with a bunch of guys every day, and A, her boyfriend doesn't mind, and B, they're not sleeping together until marriage because they're both Christians. Like, okay, that's funny.
And it's a great vehicle for her kind of naughty, oblivious schoolgirl kind of delivery. Sure. You know, yeah. And it's like, if the movie's like 114 minutes, and if it had been like 84 minutes, you know, I wouldn't have noticed that she's gone for so much time.
Every movie should be 84 minutes.
Not only is she gone for so much time, but there are moments when she shows up in the scene and nothing is about her. Mm. She's just off to the side, or in the dance number, she's dancing with Giovanni Ribisi. But she's just is like it's they photograph her and him as though they're just another couple of the background dancers. It's very weird.
So yeah, but worth seeing, I think, if you don't go
with
too high expectation. I laughed enough that I didn't leave going. Bleh.
I laughed enough that I wasn't counting how many times I.
Yeah, no, same here. But I just there's the stuff that I laughed at. I liked so much that I wish the movie had done more of that, more of the sort of absurdity and less of the pooping in a hat.
Which should people see, this or Neighbors? And I haven't seen Neighbors.
Neighbors.
Okay, yeah, yeah, Neighbors. If you're only doing one, Neighbors, by all means.
If you only see one comedy.
And then Maleficent also opens this weekend, which I only just found out. It's the first time director who was the production designer on Avatar. Mm-hmm. Although I heard he didn't direct the whole thing.
Oh, is that secret information?
I don't know.
It ain't anymore.
I was told by...
Two, three dozen people.
There you go. No, I was told by somebody who follows this stuff that apparently Disney kind of quietly replaced him about halfway through with John Lee Hancock, but then they kept this guy's name on.
Wait, of Maleficent.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. And so...
Is this information that's out in public?
I believe so.
Okay.
Look, allegedly. It's what I heard. Don't quote me on it. In any event, I what's weird about this film is that I think that the visuals are the weakest part of it.
Pause this.
Okay, we paused to make sure that we weren't going to get anybody in trouble, but this is apparently news. Like, The Hollywood Reporter and IndieWire wrote about the fact that Hancock came in to do reshoots, so...
Yeah.
So there. Anyway, there we go. So, but usually, so you'd imagine if a movie's going to be directed by a production designer, oh, well, it's going to look amazing, even if the rest of it is garbage. And oddly enough, I had the complete opposite take. I thought the script was terrific, I really liked the lead performance, and I thought it's an awful movie to look at.
Could it be just you and me thinking this? Because
I've read reviews that are completely opposite from us that have said, oh, well, it looks great.
We saw it at the Arclight Sherman Oaks. Mm-hmm. Now, is that their normal 3D process, their glasses and stuff that you always get when you go to Arclight Sherman Oaks? Garbage 3D?
Well, Arclight Sherman Oaks, Arclight Hollywood did, maybe still does, have that awful X-Band, which is my
I don't know
favorite.
That they do anymore.
Maybe not. I mean, I was there the other night for something else, and I saw a table of 3D glasses set up, and they had a mixture of – they had a few of the old X-Band ones, but mostly had what we got at Sherman Oaks, which is
– Well, I hate those too.
Which is the – do you get the – did they ever show you something in the Dolby 3D? It's those black plastic glasses that don't fold, and they have like the really kind of narrow, like the lenses aren't very high.
No.
They're very rectangular. Mm. I mean, I like Real D. Mm. I like the just the you know, but yeah, the, for some reason in Los Angeles,
Knife is sponsored by Real D.
In Los Angeles, where you think they would know better about how to project this stuff, we get this Dolby, and so there's these really kind of short rectangle things you're squinting through.
You move your head a millimeter. Mm. And everything goes double.
I'm not going to just blame the 3D for why I thought Maleficent looked terrible.
It was overpacked with things.
Yeah.
That's true.
But like, have you seen the movie?
Yes. I've seen Maleficent. I've seen the other movie.
Cool. Well, did you, when they shrink the three British actresses mm-hmm. down to fairy size, mm-hmm. didn't they kind of look Jack the Giant Slayer-ish?
Well,
their heads were sort of misproportioned.
Yeah. I mean, one thing I was saying after the movie, it's like the Mudos and Godzilla were less horrifying than the little fairies, you know? I mean, they're just kind of like, it's like Imelda Staunton's one, and uh-huh. they're kind of like scrunched up apple women,
yes!
you know?
Yes. It's very disconcerting. Although I was thrilled the Juno Temple for once was not playing like, you know, cheap Christmas trash. Mm-hmm. You know, yeah. I think I said it, the last time we saw her play some like, you know, Teen Tramp. I was like, could she just be a district attorney for once? So I'll settle for Magical Fairy.
One thing about the way it looks is that, to me, it wasn't just, I didn't think it looked that good, but it also looked like kind of every other movie that's like this.
Well, it's very on trend in terms of the fantasy film that's happening now, the Jack the Giant Slayer kind of movies, the Hansel and Gretel. Everything is this puffed up, blown up, colorful, singing psychedelic flowers and magical creatures and wood nymphs and all. It's just, there's so much going on.
It looked like a toilet paper commercial, that forest.
Yeah. There's a part where there's like this tree monster is like roaring at the camera.
Yeah.
And I swear I've seen that roaring like in Avatar and in Star Trek. And it's like we were saying about them handing around the recipes for diarrhea. It's like, I've got this program for a roaring monster. I'm going to take the scales off and put on wood and moss, you know. But it's basically the same.
It's the visual effects Wilhelm scream. Mm. Yeah, no, I know what you mean. It did feel very familiar. Mm. And it's funny. I mean, I was thinking, I guess technically this does fit into the current trend of let's take storybook characters and give them swords.
Yeah.
But I didn't mind it so much in this one. I compared it to Ms. 45 actually in my review, because it's, I mean, as Bibbs called it, I think, like, you know, finally a rape and redemption story for the whole family.
Oh really?
Yes.
I haven't seen this review yet.
She doesn't actually get raped, but she does suffer at the hands of the one human that she trusts.
She's mutilated.
She is mutilated.
They mutilate
her. She is assaulted.
Yeah.
And seeks revenge against him, which is why she places the curse when he becomes king on his young daughter, Aurora. The bad guy here is Shoto Copley from District 9.
Shoto?
I think that's how you say it.
Huh.
I interviewed him once. That's what they told me. Yeah. Charlto? I don't know.
Charlto.
Well, and it's funny in that that happens, you know, with her being mutilated and being betrayed. And so she turns into, she's always called Maleficent, but she's kind of like a Maxfield Parrish-y kind of, you know. And then she got like, turns into, you know, the character you see in Sleeping
into
Beauty,
someone,
you know,
who is Maleficent.
Yeah, yeah.
Which was like, this is a word with a meaning. Yeah. Why does this lovely little
this
fairy
lovely little girl named Evil?
Exactly.
Yeah, these are my brothers, you know, Insidious and Dooku. You know,
and they're lovely too, right? Yeah, that's one part of the retrofitting here that didn't quite work.
I was kind of hoping if it was been a different kind of movie, there would have been like a sassy fairy, and then when she comes out in the, you know, classic regalia, they would say like, "Girl, you look Maleficent."
And like, if her, maybe her original name had been, you know, Munificent or something.
Yeah, that would be perfect.
And then she got nicknamed. Yeah,
I am Munificent no more.
Yeah. Bingo. Yes. We're giving you gold here, Hollywood.
But like you're saying, it's kind of the, there's like the relationship with her and Shoto Copley's character, but there's also a relation comes up with her and Aurora,
right,
who doesn't know who she is, you know, and she kind of likes Aurora against all her instinct and better judgment.
She could probably tell Aurora who she is, and it wouldn't have scanned, because Aurora doesn't know her butt from a hole in the ground.
Yeah, she's even as played by Elle Fanning, she's kind of a ditz. Mm-hmm. But no, I one of the things, at first I was like, wait a minute, why is she softening? And I thought, well, 16 years is a long time to hold a grudge, yeah. You know, especially against the relatively innocent party and all this. You know?
And it's a funny dynamic, yeah. And it's interesting. You know, it's kind of I mean, you could almost have like a play with the two of them as the main characters, and it would be pretty interesting.
Sure,
you know?
It's like the dog who's nice to the mean old guy, mm-hmm. and finally breaks the mean old guy into being nice to the dog back.
I really liked the story. Mm-hmm. I think it's a cool way to take this fairy tale. I think it's, you know, the kind of, you know, middling okay feminism that is what Hollywood likes to pat itself on the back for.
I was surprised at how much it reminded me of Frozen, given that they were in production at the same time, mm-hmm. basically. But it had a similar sense of, like, the idea that you're waiting around for, you know, a magical prince and true love's kiss is bunk.
Yeah.
And I do really, really, really think Angelina Jolie is just terrific throughout. All she has to do is raise an eyebrow. And you're like, you're so great. You know, like, she's just this oversized movie star. And this is an oversized character. And I think she's perfect in it.
It's funny. I agree, but I also think that there's parts where you see her, like, flying around with the wings in CGI style and, like, swooping and practically doing, like, barrel rolls, you know? And it's, like, and it's almost, like, diminishing her presence in the movie. It's kind of like the criticism of Yoda in Attack of the Clones when he would, like, do all these, like, jumping around and flipping and, like, being, like, a monkey, you know? And some people think it's awesome, and some people think that it's, like, kind of killing the character, you know? And I wouldn't want to do without Yoda jumping around and flipping, but I see the point.
Well, Yoda's old later, you know, where this is young Yoda Chronicles.
True.
So I'm kind of mixed on this, but I think for the most part, for the stuff that I'm more interested in, which is the writing and the acting, I think it totally works. It's written by Linda Wolverton, who did the 1991 Beauty and the Beast. And so she kind of gets these types of stories.
How much is this like Wicked? I've never seen or read all of Wicked.
I don't know anything.
Know Wicked?
I've never seen a dang thing about Wicked.
I'm a bad gay.
There's some... One of them's green and one of them's pink, and well, they fight. Now, do they fight or no?
No, it's basically when they're both at witch school, and it's sort of explaining that
Glenn, aren't they supposed to be sisters?
No.
I don't know what's that.
But it basically kind of boils down to...
They're going to make a movie of Wicked, though, right?
I'm amazed I haven't
known when I see it, I'll know the story.
I think my impression is that Glinda is the sort of mean sorority girl, and that Elphaba, the Wicked Witch of the West, is kind of the... nerd who is turned, you know, wicked. But I haven't seen it, so I don't really know.
Sorry to take us down that road, brick road to nowhere. Yeah.
I mean, I even mentioned in my review, I said it's like Wicked in that it's sort of giving you the perspective from the witch's, you know, point of view. I feel like there's just no getting around the kind of third act ticking clock, you know, seemingly impossible race against time, and then it all seems that all is lost, and then suddenly it isn't. Like, I there's something about big budget movies being so locked into that format that makes me crazy.
And
sometimes.
It's like, and the more impossible it seems, there's no way they can survive it. It's like the stakes almost disappear because it's like, well, if it's impossible, then they'll just find some reason to get around it. You know?
We'll be talking about Edge of Tomorrow, and there's some of that in that kind of made me.
There's that part in The Desolation of Smaug when one of the dwarves is like, they're fighting Smaug at the end. He's like on the snout of Smaug, and it's like, oh, come on, you know, it's like just make him think. He doesn't have to be that crazy and periled, because then it's just sort of CGI nonsense.
Well, and plus the idea that there's no weight to somebody risking their life because no one ever dies in these movies. Like when it seems like the hero is completely gonna like just throw themselves into the volcano or whatever, you know that somehow he's going to swim out of the volcano because heaven forbid that you know, someone actually make a sacrifice in one of these movies and it counts, you know. It's a lot of having our cake and eating it. But anyway, but no, but Loves is worth checking out. Might be a little, what do you think, too scary for little kids? Or
my 11-year-old loved it. Okay. So maybe like preschoolers, probably not. Like kindergarten might be kind of like a good cutoff point, you know.
Okay, fair enough. Well, we have an actual parent. Yeah. You can explain it.
I told my daughter, I was asking me what I thought of it, and I thought it was, I thought it was okay. And she was like, what do you mean? Okay. I was like, well, I thought this, but that's okay if you don't think the same thing.
Excellent.
Defend yourself, child.
One of my favorite movies, I think maybe my favorite movie of this year so far, is opening in limited release this weekend, Lucas Moodysson's We Are the Best.
Yeah.
It's based on a graphic novel by his wife, who has the wonderful name Coco Moodysson. It's about three teen girls in 1982 Stockholm who decide to start a punk band, even though only one of them can actually play an instrument. And it's so fun and life-affirming, and it felt really true to me. I saw it originally last year when we were looking at international films for the Spirit Awards. Gabby Hoffman and I were big champions of it, but nobody else seemed to quite get it. And as soon
who were these other people? What were their problems?
They shall remain anonymous. But
name names.
But when I saw the film, though, I immediately thought, oh, God, I got to see this again. With Dave White.
Yes.
It's so good. I mean, I was never in a band.
Mm-hmm.
But this film captures perfectly that sort of insane thrill of discovery where something in the culture comes along and you know that it's just for you. And for me, in the 80s, that was punk rock. And so so watching these, you know, well, 13-year-old girls in the film, they were 11 when it was shot, which I think was a brilliant casting decision because it gives the director a chance to say to these 11-year-olds, all right, you're playing 13. I know you're like little sixth graders now, but think of how cool it's going to be when you're in eighth grade and how awesome you're going to be and how you're going to just run everything. Be those girls. Be those aggressive, confident, push people out of your way kind of girls. And so they were in this film, and it's such a pleasure to watch these children sort of like barge their way into the world and say, this is what we are and this is what we're going to do. Spread out, everybody. I loved it so much.
And they build to that. They don't kind of, then, well, one of them kind of starts at that point. The others don't.
The others, one of them is sort of like ready to go along for the ride and the other one needs to be dragged. But by mid-movie, she's on board too. She's like, oh yeah, I'm into this, you know. And so It is a beautifully made film as well. You know, in my review on movies.com, it has not yet posted because they haven't built a page for it yet or something. There's some technical thing that goes along. Every time I review an indie film for movies.com, they have to build a page for it because they don't – I guess it doesn't sell tickets. It's a ticket-selling site, really. It doesn't sell them tickets, so they're just like, yeah, we'll get to building that page in a minute. You know, so, like, it hasn't posted yet. It will. But I compared it to Maurice Pialat's Naked Childhood, L'Enfance Nue. Stylistically, because he shoots them in a very sort of documentary-like way, that very sort of naturalist way. The camera is, like, right up here and you know, follows them around their houses, and this is very sort of intimate sort of family ritual stuff and childhood,
and a lot of the character is revealed by just little throwaway looks or jokes or, you know, kind of just transitory moments of them in gym class or whatever.
Yeah, it's not just subject matter that appealed to me. It's really just formally a really beautiful film as well. But the subject matter is delightful because they even get it's kind of like, all right, here's one of my criticisms about movies in general. I'm a big contemporary art fan. Like, I go to galleries, I go to museums all the time. I'm aware of this stuff. I read about it, I look at it, I study it. It's just a hobby of mine, like making spaghetti casserole. But it's but I don't talk about it so much on the podcast because, unlike spaghetti casserole, it is a thing that no one cares about except for seven other people in the world.
I'm way more interested in the spaghetti casserole.
I understand this. Anyway, every time they talk about contemporary art or show any aspect of that world in films, it's almost always wrong. They almost always get it wrong, and it's always coming from a place of, isn't this stuff stupid? And so every time I see that in a film, I think, oh, no, they're going to do this. Someone's going to go to a gallery and see something they don't understand and be like, ah, I fart on this, you know. And then some, you know, knucklehead will come along and try to explain it to them. And they'll come on, and they'll be an idiot, and they'll be laughed at, and it's, who cares, you know. And punk rock has had a similar history in the media. One of my favorite things in the world is old 80s episodes of TV shows where they do a punk rock episode. Punk Rock Quincy.
Punk Rock Mama's Family.
Punk Rock Chips. At least those three off the top of my head. They did episodes about punk rock. All of them were out of control ridiculous. Movies don't really get it very much right either. Even some of the John Hughes movies had moments of this stuff, and it was always sort of exaggerated and weird. And you would think they would have been a little more accurate, but no. And so to see these girls get up on stage and perform a song that is a caterwaul, essentially, but that sounds so much like early 80s New York no wave, kind of just screech and bang kind of stuff. It's deeply authentic. And like beat happening mixed with Lydia Lunch and just this nasty noise.
And the whole kind of pre-digital culture of like records and zines and yeah. how you had to track this stuff down. Like the Patton Oswalt thing about how
you had to go hunt.
You had to go find the comics or the bootlegs or the whatever if you wanted to follow this stuff. It wasn't just all on
the And you had to deal with social isolation as well.
Right, yeah.
So it's really a beautiful, but they get the attitude right perfectly. Like there, I read an interview this week with the main girl in the film, the one who sort of instigates the entire situation, Mira something.
Who plays Clara.
Yeah. They asked her, you know, what she knew about punk rock. And, you know, she's born in the year 2000. And so she said, I knew that it existed. Like, I knew the name. I knew the word punk rock. I knew the expression. I did not know what it was. I had to be taught. And I also thought that Elvis lived in the 1980s. That's a quote from this kid. And so,
what do you know about jitterbug?
Yeah. To get that attitude just right, when she gets up on the stage and screams in the most sarcastic way possible, like, we're the prettiest girls in town. That's a super riot girl kind of way to approach femininity, sexuality, you know, your place in the beauty pecking order, that kind of stuff. It is as though they had listened to Bikini Kill, 15 years before Bikini Kill ever existed. This is a perfect movie. And one of the things I said in my review is I wish our friend, the late filmmaker Sarah Jacobson, were alive to see this. Because she was the punk rockest girl, one of the punk rockest girls I've ever known in my life. She made two features, I Was a Teenage Serial Killer, and Mary Jane's Not a Virgin Anymore, both of them in the 90s. And she lived for making cool underground movies and punk rock. There was nothing else for her. She died in 2004 of cancer. When she was, what, 31,
something
32, just
like that,
ridiculously
yeah.
young. And she would have eaten this up. She was a huge champion of Ladies and Gentlemen, The Fabulous Stains, this other really wonderful movie about girls and punk rock. and she made a short film about
she did a segment for some show on like Sundance Channel. She and Sam Green did like where they tracked down a bunch of people, and then didn't she write?
She
that
wrote a big article about it for the Beastie Boys magazine Grand Royal that was around about. Have you seen 15 years ago?
I have not seen Sting.
Oh my God, that was like one of the wallpaper movies of Night Flight. Back in the day, remember that show? you should check it out. It's Baby Diane Lane and Baby Laura Dern.
Yeah,
and this I forget the other actress's name. And they're like these three girls in this like just dead steel town, and this sort of like over the hill band shows up and plays, and they basically hitch a ride with them to become their opening act, even though they have no idea how to play anything or whatever. And this movie was made in 1980, and it saw Riot Girl and Madonna coming.
And the Go-Go's.
And, yeah, but
the Go-Go's were already around, but the career trajectory of the Go-Go's is very weirdly, uncomfortably close to the storyline of Fat Man Stains.
Yeah. It's a great movie. Yeah.
The a thing I would add to what y'all are saying about We Are the Best is just that it's not just about the punk rockness, but also just the coming of age and adolescence. Yes.
And outsiderness.
And all kind of in proportion of like what it feels like, you know, the first time you get drunk at a party and the first time you and your best friend have a fight over, you know, a romantic person, you know, or something like that. So, but it's like, it's not, it doesn't blow those things up in a movie way. It's like, this is how it is in real life. It doesn't have to be these grand kind of gestural things. And they're triumphant at the end. Is they're not like winning a contest on TV. By any means.
Everyone still hates them at the end of the film. Yeah. That's the other wonderful thing, and that's not a spoiler. But
they know they were great.
I loved this so much that when the boys came along in the middle of the film, I thought, oh, God.
The boys are going to screw it up.
The boys are going to screw it up, and the film is going to prioritize the boys and their crushes on the boys and derail this amazing thing. And then it doesn't.
Nope.
Which is just, I just felt this great relief when, you know, again, these aren't really spoilers. When one of them says, look, we're in a band. This doesn't matter. I was just like, that's right.
Lucas Moody is in his, this movie reminded me of the films of his that I really love, which, you know, he did Together, which is set in a sort of the waning days of a 70s commune. And in that movie, like, in the same way, I think We Are the Best nails the period details, but it doesn't feel trapped in amber. It feels current.
Right.
It feels now. It feels, you know, of the moment. And then, like, his movie Show Me Love, a.k.a. Effing Em All, which is great. It's in my I listed it in
it's in your
in 101
it's
movies.
In your out of print book.
Yes, you know, it's which is this great sort of teen girl love story. It really kind of just nails the weird obsessions, but also the intelligence and the restlessness of teenage girls. And did you take your daughter to We Are the Best?
I saw it on a screener, so she hasn't seen it yet.
She should see it.
Yeah.
I think every young girl should see this movie.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. I would say one other thing. It's kind of a graphic novel deep cut, but the character of Clara is almost exactly like young Hopi from Love and Rockets,
who
was a punk rock girl with black hair and the back, basically the exact same. It's like they cast a live person to play that role, only not in
Scandinavian
like,
version.
Yeah, not in Mexico or wherever, Southern California. But you know,
good call. No, that's a very
yeah, that makes sense.
Do we know if the original, if the graphic novel it's based on was ever published in English?
I don't know
because I would love to read it.
Right,
you know, now that I've seen this movie,
why don't you learn Swedish?
Yeah, I will work on that.
do we want to table Night Moves?
We can talk about it next week.
Yeah, let's talk about it next week. It's a limited release.
It's the new film from Kelly Reichardt with Jesse Eisenberg and is it Elle Fanning again?
Dakota Fanning.
Dakota Fanning, right? Sorry, A. Fanning and Peter Sarsgaard.
Number one Fanning. It's Dakota.
There you go. All right, yeah, we'll talk about that next time. What's your DVD pick?
I already talked about this once before when it came out on DVD, but now it's coming out on Blu-ray, so I feel like I should get to talk about it again.
Every new format.
I believe, yes. Leviathan comes out on Blu-ray this Tuesday, and if you ignore me...
Not the monster movie and not the Russian movie that just played at the Cannes Film Festival. The other Leviathan.
The documentary about about the fishing industry.
From the guys that made Sweetgrass.
From the guys that made Sweetgrass. And when I say it's a documentary about the fishing industry, I don't want that to turn you off, because it is one of the most, like, blackly beautiful films that I've seen in years. It's gorgeous to look at. It's weird and intense. It's almost completely silent.
It's the art house version of Deadliest Catch.
It is. It is. Yeah, that's actually a good description. Thank you. It takes cameras onto a fishing boat and shows you everything in the weirdest, creepiest, most black metal kind of way that they can, and it's gothic in the best possible sort of Herman Melville way.
Sense.
Yeah, I love it so much. You must see this film.
Kurt, what do you got?
I was thinking about Westerns because of A Million Ways to Die in the West and Western comedies, and I thought of Cat Ballou, the Jane Fonda comedy with Lee. Did Lee Marvin win the best
supporting actor? Lee Marvin won an Oscar for that. Yeah.
Supporting or actor?
Best actor.
Okay, well, yeah, that's pretty amazing.
Well, he plays two roles.
Yeah, it's hard to do. Yeah, one of them is she's. I can't remember all the details exactly of which it's a shame because I'm recommending this film on your podcast. But she's like a young woman whose father gets killed, and she has to kind of become a gunslinger herself to see that justice is served.
Right.
And Lee Marvin plays kind of a washed up drunk gunslinger who trains her, and also a villain who has had his nose shot off, so he has a metal nose
onto his head.
Yeah, and it's very light and funny, and it's Jane Fonda before kind of all the baggage involving Jane Fonda came up,
It's actually, it's weird, because I read her memoir, and mm-hmm. it's she would say it's sort of the when she was sort of, before she kind of had her stuff together, she talks about how you can tell in her early movies she speaks in a very high register, mm-hmm. because and apparently that's a common trait of women who are not self-possessed, mm-hmm. and that later when she sort of mm-hmm. was more in control of her own life, or as she puts it, she was in a deeper one. So I like Baggagey Jane Fonda too, but no, she's very sweet. And what is it? It's Nat King Cole and Stubby K.
And it's very funny and light and easy, mm-hmm. and enjoyable, and the music is great.
Yeah.
And this is, if you have to choose one, that's my main one. But another movie that I really like that's much more recent is another Western comedy with a Greek chorus, the animated movie Rango, with Johnny Depp as a chameleon who gets caught up in this Western town, and all the characters are Western animals.
Right.
Like, they ride roadrunners, and the Greek chorus is a band of mariachi owls and all that. And partly it's a fun, neat riff on Westerns and the plot of Chinatown to an extent. And because Liam Neeson's character in A Million Ways to Die in the West is named, I believe, Clinch Leatherwood.
Yes.
There's a Clint Eastwood analog in Rango, too, who's like called the Spirit of the West.
And
transparently who it is.
And it's voiced by Timothy Oliphant.
Yeah, yeah. So.
What does he say? If this were heaven, we'd be eating Pop-Tarts with Kim Novak. That's my... I can't think of a quote from a film that I love more than that.
Everybody liked Rango more than I did, so I'm just... I'll allow it.
Guess what, guys?
Wait.
What?
I haven't done my DVD pick.
Oh, all right. Do it.
Yeesh. My DVD pick this week, which also streaming, is which inspired by We Are the Best, Josie and the Pussycats, which is a smarter than most people think movie about girls and rock and roll.
If you didn't see it, it's because you were listening to the wrong people.
Exactly. It has a reputation in some circles for people that didn't get it, but it's a great movie. And it's also the subject of the next Linoleum Knife Presents More Linoleum Knife. So now would be a great time to catch up with it, so that when we release our next extra episode and you buy it, then you can watch the movie again. Listening to our
nobody bought
thoughts.
Two for the Road.
Some people.
Nine people bought Two for the Road.
It was a little less, we kind of knew that it wasn't going to have the Clue marquee value, but, we felt good about doing it anyway.
Josie and the Pussycats, first of all, the Brooklyn Academy of Music agrees with you and me,
because mm-hmm.
they just screened Josie and the Pussycats alongside Breaking Glass
Fabulous
and
Stains.
Fabulous Stains and something else.
Times Square.
in conjunction with a screening of We Are the Best. Mm-hmm. So
I would put Starstruck on that list too.
Yeah, that's a good one too. So yeah, that's we're doing that next as our next commentary because you know we're trying to drum up business. Yeah. Guess what? This time,
what
guys?
Dave White.
We have sponsors.
Yay!
One of our sponsors is Focal Press. You can go to Focal with an F. F as in fancy.
Mm-hmm.
Like
M as in Mancy.
Mancy.
You know, sorry to interrupt you.
Go right ahead.
2 years ago, I did a Cradle Open cover story about Archer, which is filmed here. And I asked him about M as in Mancy, Adam Reed, the creator of the show. And he said that he basically, the episode that has that, he was working on it, basically came up with the phrase M as in Mancy first, and then basically reverse engineered the plot of the show to build to that line. Yeah.
It was worth it. Yeah.
Okay, so Focal Press, they've been our sponsor recently. They're our new sponsor. They are – you can go to them. You can go to focalpress.com to find out all the information. But they publish books about how to make movies. The first one we told you about was the Shut Up and Shoot documentary guide. Last week we told you about the TV Showrunner's Roadmap. And this week's is – as I scroll down my ad copy, it is hang on.
Oh, my God.
I'm getting it. Right to TV.
Oh, is that W-R-I-T?
W-R-I-T-E. Right to TV. Out of your head and onto the screen. By Marty Cook. You will learn to craft smart, original stories and scripts for a variety of television formats and genres, including comedy, drama, pilots, animation, made-for-TV movies, late-night, reality, all the different televisions. Hear directly from studio and network executives, agents, and managers on what they're looking for in new writers and how to avoid common pitfalls. Gain access to sample outlines, script pages, checklists, and I love checklists.
They're the best.
I make checklists almost every day.
I know you do.
For myself. To-do lists and checklists.
Do you make little empty boxes that you can check in the box?
Sometimes. I'll start that sentence again. Gain access to sample outlines, script pages, checklists, and countless other invaluable resources that will help you break into the industry and put you on the path to immediate success.
Well, all right.
Not future success. It's going to happen the minute you finish reading the book. You won't have to have done anything. It's just going to be the minute you finish reading it.
Guaranteed.
The name of the book is Right to TV, Out of Your Head and Onto the Screen by Marty Cook. That is from Focal Press. And
we will have a link to purchase the book on our Facebook page.
Go to focalpress.com. That's what you go to.
Who else is this show brought to you by, Dave White?
The Real Truth, R-E-E-L. Real Truth. Everything you didn't know, you needed to know about making an independent film by Reed Martin.
Boy, howdy, yes.
Who has not, because he could not, because we jumped the gun by 48 hours, send us any ad copy.
Yes.
So here goes.
But we've been telling you for weeks now that this book, it's all the stuff, as the title says, it's everything you need to know.
You're in my way.
I'm warming up for when you get to.
You're
get
in my way.
Fine.
You're in my way.
He's like your hype man, Dave.
Yeah.
You're in my way.
Okay.
Fine. I got this.
Fine. Go on.
So many weeks now we've been telling you about The Real Truth. The greatest book that has ever been written about how to make a film. Sorry, Focal Press. You have learned to love The Real Truth, even though you have not yet read it, probably.
Although some people have bought it.
Now is your chance to have a copy. We are going to give you a copy of The Real Truth. You are going to earn your free copy of The Real Truth with my favorite way of organizing a contest, essay writing. You are going to write... What was it the last time? 25 words or less?
I think so, yes.
I'll up it to 50 in case some of you like words a lot. And so 50 words or less. Don't go over 50. You go over 50 and we will throw your entry away. That's what happened in the last time we were giving something away. Mm-hmm. And we said 25 words or less. And people turned in paragraph after paragraph explaining why they were deserving of the Your Next Goat Mask.
Now it's garbage.
Guess what we did with your entry? In the trash. So... 50 words or less, why you deserve a copy of The Real Truth. It would help you if you were remembering some of the things we told you about The Real Truth, all the different chapters, and maybe perhaps stories of directors who did terrible things for a living before they were directors, like working in gross places.
Or the legal pitfalls of having an unregistered screenplay.
Yeah, people who can steal things from you. We told you about that.
Not having permits.
So get on it. Get back. Get your memory in order.
Go back and listen to the old episodes.
Get your 50-word count together. You can have a copy of The Real Truth from us and Reed Martin and Faber and Faber Press. That's the ad this week. Get yourself a free copy. And if you lose, then you have to go buy one.
If you already know that you're a terrible essay writer and you want to go buy one, we'll have a link to that as well on our Facebook page. Do we have letters, Dave White?
We do.
Letter time for the
No, man. No, wrong show, wrong show.
What show is that?
He's doing his Elliot Kalin from the Flophouse. Letters from listeners.
Oh yeah, we don't sing the letters song here.
I was thinking of words that rhyme with Duralde at one point too.
Flurflalde. Dear Alonzo and Dave, aka Man of Many Nicknames. I only have one nickname now. Sex happening. Yeah. Emboldened by what I was assuming was Alonzo's comment that I was exceedingly knife when buying the Two for the Road extra episode, despite knowing I'm probably not very, I wanted to drop a line to say how much I enjoy your much, much less depressing than the Lockhorns married folk bantering and Dave's many mentions of his baking and cooking. I still think about his description of
Spaghetti casserole,
which captured both the simple charm and the gloppy unappealingness of comfort foods in the 9x13 category. I hope that never changes. Fight the network notes, guys.
Get us a network, and then we'll ignore their notes.
We've had notes from non-network people who ready to tell us all kinds of ways we can improve ourselves. Guess what? We can't be tamed. We can't be learned.
We are the best.
We are the best. I have been an enthusiastic reader of Dave's reviews since the iFilm days.
Whoa.
Yeah.
There's a callback.
I wrote for iFilm from 1999 to 2001. Mm-hmm. I was their film critic from 2000 to 2001.
And you single-handedly put them out of business.
I drove them into the ground.
Was that when you saw everything, or was that?
Yeah, that was when I saw everything. I thought I would lose my mind, and I wasn't even a film critic then. Like they said, all right, each review, make it 5 bullet points and make a joke for every bullet point. One of the bullet points was always when to go to the bathroom. Like, these were not film reviews. I was not a film critic. When people would describe me back then as a film critic, I'd be like, no. Jonathan Rosenbaum is a film critic. I am an idiot. And so that's iFilm. Mm. Long gone.
Yep.
Yeah. And I own Exile in Guyville.
No. Oh.
The Liz Phair album. No, he's talking about my out of print book. I hesitate to say these things, knowing as I now do, Dave's love of playing Mr. Big Ego. I'm not playing.
That's true.
That's not playing.
Alonzo, that guy with the big head.
Yeah, Alonzo, your recent trilling of agony a la Into the Woods in the Days of Future Past episode was delightful.
Oh, thanks.
Does that help combat Dave's gloating? No. And your recaps of Fargo are so great and appreciated.
Oh, thank you.
Oh, and what you recap Fargo for What the Flag. Yeah. This is basically a letter where we're just being loved, I think. Uh-huh. Hang on. Which is good.
Sure.
Send more of those. send more letters where you just tell us how great we are. I love you both equally in different ways. I don't know that I'm organized enough to put together a top 10 list, but I instead will confess that as a girl/teen, I was obsessed with the movie Three Fugitives. Do you remember that one? where Nick Nolte is a bank robber, and so is Martin Short, who has a daughter stricken mute by grief, and they go on the run and become a family. I never saw this movie.
I never did either. That was that period where Disney was remaking all the French comedies, the Francis Weber comedies. And I think that's a remake. Francis Weber actually maybe even directed this one.
I think my adolescent hormones and Nick Nolte's ursine charms before he became mugshot crazo unappealing had a lot to do with my repeated viewings. It's one of those movies from the late 80s that I imagine does not age well if viewed in the here and now. Do either of you have a movie from that time period that you remember fondly despite knowing it is probably mediocre?
Oh, no doubt.
All of them?
Yeah, I mean, I know there are movies that I make it a point to not revisit because I just know they're not gonna, you know. I made the mistake of watching She's Having a Baby again as an adult. That's in that category with like St. Elmo's Fire of movies that seem cool before you're the age of the characters, but then once you've hit that age, you're like, oh wait, this is ridiculous.
So those films are, you had trouble being objective about some of those films, I would say. You know, that kind of the John Hughes-y thing. You could be objective. Not that you wouldn't recommend a bad one, but no, I mean, you were kind of, connecting to those.
I was drinking the Kool-Aid. Yeah. I admit that, yes.
Dudes.
I think about Dudes sometimes.
I haven't revisited Dudes in a while.
I bet it's not good now.
Probably, maybe not.
It's not good now. The other ones, I think, would be Frankenhooker, which I think is probably still great. Mm-hmm. I think Frankenhooker is probably still amazing. What else? Well, Just One of the Guys, which is still great.
You know, I wonder if Noises Off holds up. That's actually getting into the 90s now, but I was just thinking about that whole Disney Touchstone era. That movie cracked me up. Like, I was crying, clutching my sides, laughing at that movie. I wonder if it still is funny.
I wonder how Running Scared holds up.
That's what I keep thinking about going back to, and I, for some reason, never do. But, yeah, we loved that at the time, I remember. Not the Paul Walker one, the Billy Crystal, Gregory Hines one.
Yeah.
In closing... Mm-hmm. I agree with Dave. Is there a dance battle? Then I super don't care. Much adoration from Chicago, Jesse.
Oh, thanks, Jesse. That's
thank you, Jesse. One more.
Okay.
This is from Neil. Hey, guys. I just stumbled upon a top 10 list of sorts that you may find interesting. A little setup first. In my mid to late teens, every Friday, a good friend of mine and I would smoke a bunch of weed and go see every new release that came out that day. I kept a report card listing every movie we saw. It's not exactly a top 10 list per se, one reason being that there's 11 of them, but here are all the movies that received some form of the letter A. Keep in mind, this is the opinion of a stoned teenager. A-, Wyatt Earp.
Okay.
Wes Craven's New Nightmare.
I like that one. I think that's a movie that holds up.
The Flintstones. Major League. Two.
Oh, man.
In my defense on this one, somebody in the packed movie theater ripped an ear-splitting fart in the middle of the movie, making the experience exponentially more enjoyable to a baked 17-year-old.
I'm curious what the Fs would be on this.
Here's the rest of them. Forrest Gump. Eh. Wrong. The Lion King. Whatever. The Mask. The Mask is not bad.
I loved it at the time. That's another one that I wonder how it would be now.
Maverick, which I never saw.
I never saw that one. Yeah. The Mel Gibson.
Yeah. I saw it.
The Ref, which is perfect.
Oh, love it.
And City Slickers 2, The Legend of Curly's Gold.
Not so much.
And finally, one film for the whole year received an A+, Cabin Boy. Also interesting to note, I gave Pulp Fiction a C.
Well done.
Two movies received Fs, Clifford, and Blue Chips.
I have always wanted to see Clifford. That just seems so insane.
Clifford has this weird reputation where it's like people like it and some people like hate like it. So.
Yeah, it's one of those movies where the central premise is... So this seems like such a bad idea. This is the movie where Martin Short plays an 11-year-old boy.
Right.
I kind of need to see it just to just to know, you know, it just seems crazy.
Thank you, love the podcast. Neil, P.S. I could be wrong, but I feel like I once heard one of you say that you were originally from Portsmouth, New Hampshire. That's me. I was born in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. My family lived in Rye, New Hampshire, which is this tiny little beach town next to Portsmouth that had no movie theater. So I lived my movie life in Portsmouth. And then he says, I grew up right across the bridge in York, Maine. That is where we used to go to get things like ice creams. Every movie on this list was seen at the Hoyts in Newington or the Jerry Lewis on Lafayette. Jerry Lewis, I was there all the time. I was at that Jerry Lewis cinema all the time.
There were still Jerry Lewis cinemas in the 90s?
I guess there were.
Wow.
When I was there, they were showing Jaws, because that's because I'm 1,000 years old. Two theaters I'm sure you remember well, unless, of course, I'm misremembering and neither of you are from Portsmouth, in which case, please disregard this postscript. P.P.S. Okay, it was actually me who ripped the ear-splitting fart during Major League 2. That is the end of this week's letters.
Well, it's been a treat, and it's been so great having you on the show finally,
it's Kurt. It's a genuine honor being in the company of all the other guests on the show, and also not talking to a real microphone and not onto a cell phone.
You know. Oh, well, you know, we come correct. Where can people find you on the internet?
You can Google me and Creative Loafing, because you can find my reviews that way. I'm on Facebook. I'm on Twitter at
Twitter
Kurt,
me.
Twitter Kurt me. _ Holman. You know, that's easy way.
Yeah, CURT _ HOLMAN. Awesome. Well, thanks for coming. This was great to finally get you on here. As always, we thank you for listening, and we, as always, point you to our friends on the internet. Check out ChristyLemire.com, and she also is writing at RogerEbert.com these days. Check out the Rotten Tomatoes podcast with our friends Gray and Matt. Check out the B-Movies podcast with Bibbs and William. Also, Fat Guys of the Movies.
Bibbs and William.
Bibbs and Whitney, sorry. Fat Guys at the Movies, the Criterion Cast, the Schmoes Know, the Film Spotting SVU, Pod Crash, the Game Night Guys, Secretly Timid, and The Lunch. You can subscribe to the show for free at iTunes, and if you want to leave us a review, that would be great. You can also stream us at Stitcher Radio or TheLounge.com, and you can leave us nice reviews there as well. Like our Facebook page, follow us on Twitter at LinoleumCast. You can check into the show at TVTag.com. Visit our website, linoleum-knife.com, for a occasional original bits of business, otherwise links to stuff that we do elsewhere. And you can drop us a line at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com with questions or comments or top 10 lists or bottom 10 lists. And you can also
booty 10 lists.
You can PayPal us there for the Linoleum Knife t-shirts. We're about to order a new batch, and we're taking pre-orders right
pre-orders,
now.
Pre-orders, $20.
$20. It's a Hanes 100% cotton beefy tee, so let us know your size.
It and will enhance your beauty.
Yes, and where to send it. You can also...
There is a famine of beauty.
Yes. My eyes are starving. You can PayPal us $1.99 each for our extra episodes where we talk about Two for the Road or Clue or The Apple or White Christmas. And make sure you include your email address so we know where to send those. Thank you to,
everybody.
Blue did not do our theme music this week. That was Max Steiner. But in general, thank you to Blue for our theme music. You can follow him. Find him at Bluetopia.com, BLEUTOPIA. And next week we'll be back at home at our own kitchen table and... maybe the audio will be better. Whatever.
Is the audio not good this time around?
No, it's just always weird with we're sharing a mic.
And we don't have headphones.
We spent so much time stapling those egg cartons to the walls to soundproof the room, though.
Have we been too loud or too soft?
No, it's fine.
If so, get over it. We transcend sound quality.
There you go.
Because we are the best. Goodbye.